Today's date is March 4th. What's today's date? I realize I
It
don't know today's date.
is. It's March 4th. It's the March 4th. Is that a Star Wars thing?
Ah, okay. So it is March 4th, 2022. Prepared for everything except for the date. My name is Jenny O. Brown, and I am here in Elmhurst, Illinois, and I'm speaking with Jennifer Grimm.
Hi, I am Jennifer Grimm, and I am currently in Miami, Florida.
So I thought I would start our conversation just talking about diversity and equity and inclusion at the National Flute Association. And I am participating in this conversation as a member of the D&I committee. And so I thought we could start with the topic of the National Flute Association and our own connection and history within the organization.
Yeah, so I first got involved with the NFA. I feel like I've gone to some conventions, but the first time I was involved in terms of being a volunteer and doing service for the NFA was when the NFA was in my hometown or the town that I was living in Las Vegas, which was in 2012. And as being the host city in the convention in Vegas, I was asked to be the volunteer coordinator. And so, with that job, it's different now. I think that the volunteer coordinator position is a different position, but back then, each volunteer coordinator was affiliated with the host city because they were to sort of solicit people, students, adults, to help with the convention every year. And so since I was in Las Vegas, that was my duty. And so it was a lot of work just to get a lot of people involved to help with putting the convention on, being door monitors, things like that. So that was my first foray into the NFA, which was 2012. And then soon after, I believe, Jenny, you got involved in the
I was just
NFA
thinking,
in a very similar position.
absolutely. And that was actually my first time serving officially for the NFA too. And Jen, I remember there was one day that was like super, super, super crazy where it was like we felt like we were running around with our hair on fire. And all of a sudden, in the middle of the day, you showed up and you brought me a piece of pizza. And it was like the greatest thing ever. I can't even tell you how much I appreciated that. I was like, oh my gosh, food.
I know. I mean, those days of just, you sat at the information booth, just trying to like put out fires, trying to make sure everything was going smoothly. I remember I couldn't eat. I mean, we were either running around or sitting on the information booth for the entire day. And like, I knew what your job was. And so, and I knew how busy you must have been. And so, so as volunteer coordinator to fellow volunteer coordinator, we help each other out, definitely.
Absolutely. That was really just amazing. So, what was your first sort of NFA event?
Well, as a volunteer or as a
No,
performer,
just as a student or as a performer or
gosh, I was one of those people who could never afford to go to NFA when I was a student. So the first time I actually went to an NFA was when I was already teaching in college. So I'm embarrassed to say that it took me that long, but really, I mean, the costs are expensive. I know
It
the
is expensive.
organization is doing a lot to try to help that, but it was really expensive at the time and still is. And I remember the first time I think I performed was in 2006 in Pittsburgh, and it was the year that I was teaching at a small liberal arts college in Pennsylvania. And so I remember I performed as one of the winners of the convention performers competition. And so I did
Oh.
that. Yeah, so I did that back in 2006, and then after that, I think then I got my job in Las Vegas, and then I started going more regularly because my school sponsored was able to help pay for the costs. So I performed more regularly. I would apply to perform and perform more regularly during that time. And then after that, I can't. Then after that was when I did a lot of work with the volunteer jobs at 2012. And then after that, I quickly after that, I joined the Cultural Outreach Committee as chair.
Is the Cultural Outreach Committee like the predecessor of the D&I Committee?
Sorry about that. Sorry about that. So the Cultural Outreach Committee is, yes, it was the name that the name of the committee had a lot of names. And I believe the names have gotten better and better over the years. So I'm not sure exactly the exact year the committee was formed, but the committee was formed, I believe, in the early 90s. And it was called the Minority Concerns Committee, which is just, I mean, I don't even want to say that term anymore. I mean, I can't believe that, you know, very well-intentioned, but definitely not a good name for the committee. And then it was changed to Cultural Outreach Committee. And that's when I joined. And I remember at the time, I felt like the name of that committee should change. I felt like what we were doing was not really outreach. It wasn't really outreach. It was just really sort of being aware of D&I issues. And so I'm really happy now that the committee is now known as the D&I Committee, Diversity and Inclusion Committee.
Yeah, although we've been talking about like squeezing equity in there too, because you know that's a three-legged stool right there. So
it definitely is. It's one of the few committees that doesn't have the full three letters in it that I know of.
Well, I guess I didn't realize how much our NFA paths were kind of like, you know, not exactly parallel, but definitely some similarities there. I actually first went to a convention when I was in eighth grade because it was after a summer camp and the convention was in Chicago. And so like a couple girlfriends and I went and spent a day there. And I remember that the program chair at the time was Benita Boyd, who ended up being just a huge influence in my life. So it's funny the way things can work out. But kind of like you, I didn't go at all after that until I was well into my professional life, because it is really expensive. And, you know, I'm not a tenured professor, and so I wasn't sponsored to go to conventions, but at the same time, my colleges would often cover the costs. And so that made it a lot more manageable to then be able to go back out. And I performed in the Gen X concert. Like that was my first performance. And that was in California. And unlike you, I'm terrible at remembering years and dates. So I'm just not even going to try. But I remember my first performance and I was completely terrified. Like I was literally physically shaking because I was thinking about all the incredible flutists that were in the audience. And I shouldn't have been thinking that way. But of course, that's where my head was. And, you know, then I didn't go back for many years. And I think maybe the first time that I went back after that was probably that Chicago convention. And I was also part of that Chicago convention when I served as a volunteer coordinator, because if I'm remembering correctly, that was the year that Bonnie got the Lifetime Achievement Award. And I helped to coordinate her concert that was held in her honor. And I remember as the recipient of that award, she performed on the gala concert and she did this like just unbelievably difficult program. And it kicked in at like 10:30 at night.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Because she was one of the last people, maybe even the last person to perform. And boy, she just is just a powerhouse woman. Yeah. So anyway,
amazing.
And I think, you know, I'm guessing that you probably have a similar story to me, in that my primary teachers were all people who were very committed to the NFA and who were, you know, serving the NFA in many different capacities. And of course, Walfred Kujala served in a lot of different capacities. So we were, you know, the people in those studios were sort of raised to value serving the larger community through the National Flute Association.
Yeah, it is such a, you know, it's, you know, such a huge organization. And there's so many people like that, so many, you know, so many parts to make the organization whole. Like when I, you know, once I, you know, after being on the committee, I joined the board, and then being on the board, realizing like there's so many committees and so many opportunities to serve, but there's just so many like parts to what NFA is all about and so many sort of constituencies, right? So, you know, and, you know, we want to serve everyone. And so there's, you know, a committee for every kind of flutist, you know, or out there. And it just, it's so, so monstrous, but it's, you know, it really is like the one way where people can get together. And, you know, now with, you know, everything sort of being online, it makes things a little bit easier. But for the longest time, I mean, like the coming together in NFA, it was like the one chance you got to see everybody.
Yeah.
And you got to see everybody perform, you could see masterclasses, but then, you know, a big part of it was sort of the networking, socializing after the after the concerts. I mean, you know, a lot of the magic at the NFA happened, you know, after hours and just, you know, the bonding and just, you know, all of that. And I was sort of a late bloomer to that part of the NFA. I kind of, you know, I'm also kind of an introvert, so I'm not super, super outgoing that way. But I just realized that there's just so many, so many really kind, wonderful, nice people involved in the NFA. And it's just, you know, it's really nice to get a chance to go. And I'm so looking forward to going back this summer, finally, after 2 years of going this. It's just great to be able to see people in person. Yeah. And you know, and parallel to you, you know, finally this year, we're having the Lifetime Achievement Awards, which from 2020. So we were supposed to have these Achievement Award winners and the gala dinners and the tributes and all of that. That was supposed to happen in 2020. And when the convention got canceled, you know, we wanted to celebrate them in person. We felt like, you know, they deserve to have a live in-person celebration. And so we said, oh, you know, we'll just push it to 2021. No big deal. We'll push it to 2021. And then of course, 2021, it didn't happen either. So finally, fingers crossed, we're going to have the Lifetime Achievement Award winners tributes happening in Chicago. And so, and I'm in part of, the tribute for Ransom Wilson's.
Oh my goodness, award. That's amazing.
So I'm organizing his concert.
Oh my goodness.
My biggest influence. So it really is, we have like parallel, you have the same name, parallel lives, you know, so many, many things, you know. I didn't perform on that Gen X concert, but you know, the same generation, the whole thing. So.
Well, there's no one I'd rather have a parallel life to than you, Jen.
Likewise.
Well, you know, I was actually like, as I was thinking about having this conversation, I was like, how did we meet? And I like could not remember for the life of me, like what was the point that we met? And now I realize it's because of the volunteer coordinator thing.
Yeah.
So, and you know, since then, it's honestly, it's because of you that I bought my Traverso that I have. Mm-hmm. And you've given me so much like, support and wisdom. And you know, my last solo album, the instigator of that whole project was when I saw you perform Valerie Coleman's Wish Sonatine. Like I heard that performance and I was like, oh my goodness, like I just completely fell in love with the piece. And you played it just, oh my, it was just so fantastic. So there's so many ways that I owe you so much gratitude. And of course, serving on the Chamber Music America board with you is just a complete joy. So anyway, it's, and I think that kind of brings me back to what you were mentioning about how the NFA as an organization is such a behemoth of an organization, especially that type of professional organization, but it's really about the people. And it's really about this opportunity to like see people face to face, like at least just once a year and to sit down for coffee. Like I remember so many conventions where you'd have coffee like 10 times during the day. You just wanted to like connect with all these people that you don't really get to see that often.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that is just really very true of the NFA. I think people are so well-intentioned. And the other thing that always amazes me is I walk out of every single convention feeling so inspired and learning something new that, you know, then you can apply to your life in so many different ways. It's just really remarkable. I think we're very fortunate.
Yeah, I agree. It's, you know, there's so much to be gained. I, you know, I look forward to going to the masterclasses because I feel like watching other people teach really helps me with my own teaching. You know, I feel like I always want to, I constantly want to learn. And then learning about new repertoire with all the people playing concerts, just, you know, I really appreciate people, you know, presenting, I mean, the standards, yes, but also new pieces I never would have even known about if it wasn't for the convention. So I mean, all of those really great opportunities. And then like discovering new performers sometimes, you know, like, you know, you always like go to see like the big names and the celebrities, and they're so inspiring. But it's also great to see people who that you didn't necessarily know before, who are like amazing performers. There's amazing flutists everywhere. I mean, wow.
It's true. Yeah, it's totally true. And that's, you know, I'm entering my last year serving as the convention performance competition coordinator. Mm-hmm. And what I've loved about that is the connection to the newly published music competition.
Right.
And that's been so cool because, you know, I might know about certain new pieces that are published, but I don't know about like, you know, for example, the resetting of, you know, whatever Baroque sonata mm-hmm. that I didn't mm-hmm. even, you know was happening. And I mean, it's just really amazing the energy that's generated from just these different competitions.
Right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. There's so many competitions. The but with the convention performers competition, I mean, you find out about new music, like you say, but you find out about interesting transcriptions and arrangements and just things for different numbers of flutes, because you know, sometimes I know more about solo literature, but I don't know that much about flute duet or trio literature. And so you get a lot of and this is so great for teaching to know this repertoire, to have, you know, sort of more at your disposal than the same tried and true, even though the tried and true are good too. But yeah, it's just so great to have all of these options. So it's, you know, it's nice to be able to, you know, I just get so much. It's all about the music for me. I get so many ideas for flute choir. I get so many ideas for repertoire when I'm at the convention. It's great.
Yeah. So you and I both served on essentially the same committee under two different names. But I'm wondering, how has just the your commitment to diversity and how these issues have impacted your life, like how has that connected to your work and experience with the National Flute Association?
Yeah, so when I first chaired the committee, you know, we wanted to present a concert of all BIPOC composers, and you know, and it was, and I remember saying it before, like introducing one of the concerts, and I remember saying, you know, I really hope that one day I don't have to like have these kinds of concerts, that you know, that yeah. these kinds of pieces can just be on all concerts, and not we don't have to just necessarily highlight them with one special concert. They just could be all concerts, you know. It'd be great to have that. And you know, and it's been interesting to see kind of globally the attention that a lot of organizations are making toward inclusive programming, whether it's arts organizations, presenting organizations, performers wanting to perform more pieces by BIPOC composers, even university programs requiring certain pieces by BIPOC composers on their audition lists, I'm seeing now. So I think that has definitely changed from when I was, you know, starting my little, you know, cultural outreach committee concert proposal programs back in 2015 or whatever it was. And I think there has been a lot of strides in that way. Yeah. And
well, 2015 wasn't really even that long ago.
No, right. You
know? So yeah, there's a lot of movement that's been taking place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think, I appreciate that more and more people are wanting to explore this music, and you know, and also sort of discover more performers too. And there's a lot of performers out there who are, you know, doing really, really amazing, really interesting things, very talented. I mean, there's so many great flutists out there that it's great that more people are finding people who are maybe less quote unquote famous, but are really, really great performers and featuring them. And I appreciate that that's starting to happen more and more now.
Yeah, it's sort of like this loosening just across the industry from these sort of paradigms that we've become so accustomed to, which I think is definitely a move in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And how have you felt about your experiences with diversity issues in the larger field? You kind of talked a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, so it's, you know, it's been interesting. It's been interesting being sort of a professional musician nowadays, when I was growing up, I wasn't planning on being a professional flutist. I think my mom wanted me to be like, quote unquote, successful. So she wanted me to like be a doctor or a lawyer. I think it was like one of those two options and that was it. And so I think she, you know, had the best intentions for me, but she kind of was like, you can't really make any money doing music. And like, why do you want to do that? And I was like, well, you know, it's what I really love to do. And, you know, all those things, but she's kind of like, eh, no. And so I never saw anyone like me doing it. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like I couldn't do it, but I just sort of didn't think that this was something that someone like me would do. You know, it was not a part of my family. You know, no one's a musician in my family, you know, and I didn't see a lot of people that looked like me doing it. So I didn't really think that this was a viable option. I didn't think that it was like, oh, like I can't do it because I'm Black or I'm mixed or whatever. It just was like, oh, I guess, you know, it's just not, I don't see people doing it. So I just don't do it, I guess. So for me, it was kind of like, I wasn't thinking to pursue it because I just didn't know it was an option. And then having an epiphany and kind of just like, well, like, what if this is the one thing I really love to do? I don't really want to study, you know, biology. I really want to study music. And I said, well, let me just try. And so then when I applied to graduate school and, you know, went to graduate school and then moved on, you know, it was very apparent that, you know, there were very, very few people of color studying classical music. And so that was like something that I noticed for sure. And, you know, it was something that I just also at the time, I just was like, well, this is just how it is. And, you know, it's a little bit of a generational thing. I think young people nowadays, you know, think about it very differently than how I thought about it in the 90s. You know, I mean, I'm probably a product of affirmative action, possibly, you know, in my undergrad. So, you know, I very much admit that, you know, do I like it? Not necessarily, but like that was what the situation was. And so, you know, and then going to grad school and having my teacher sort of take a chance on me, and he saw some potential in me, and I really, really struggled. And I wasn't really sure if this is what I could do or not. But, you know, over like a long period of time, I sort of just tried as much as I could to do what I could, and eventually kind of made things happen for me. And then since the time I was in school till now, like I just see many more people like really, really thriving and doing so well. And it's just so great to see that, yeah. You know, I mean, it was not in my vocabulary earlier on. It just wasn't in my vocabulary, not for any reason. I just never saw people like me, and I just didn't think that this was like a viable option. And now I'm seeing so many people thrive. So that's really great to see.
It is really exciting. Yeah, I remember when I was in grad school, and I sort of got connected with a bunch of composers. Like that was sort of like a major part of my friend group. And I remember there was a composer that said, Jenny, you've got to check out this piece, Spiral, by Chinadi Ung, who is now like really truly one of my heroes. And I had never, it occurred to me, I'd never heard a piece by someone who wasn't European.
Wow.
Prior to then. And that was in grad school. So like it wasn't Wow. even anywhere in my undergrad. And it was just completely mind blowing because I loved the piece. Like the piece just really spoke to me. And I've probably listened to that recording like multiple thousands of times. Mm-hmm. And I then used it like in my teaching. And, you know, it's just a great example of so many different, compositional elements and things. Yeah. But that was just like, you know, when you talk about this epiphany, that was my epiphany moment where I thought, oh my goodness, there's so much more out there than this repertoire that I really, really loved. But, right. You know, what was really speaking to me was this other repertoire that could express like my cultural heritage in some way, or could express my experience in a different way. And I think that was sort of maybe my version of what you were experiencing as well, is like, I just didn't even know that that was a thing, that there could be music that wasn't Beethoven, Bach, and Mozart that would be really complicated, really intense, really inspiring, and all of those things. And so that was something that was really moving to me. And of course, now, like you, you're just seeing so much more of that in the repertoire, as well as, you know, the not only the people on stage, but also the people behind the scenes too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea of having organizations where the leadership is much more representative and much more diverse and able to identify with these different, larger, broader issues.
Right. I agree. I hope that that starts to happen more often. I feel like there's still some ways to go with leadership. Like, I think real change begins at the top. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of change happening sort of at our ranks, but I think more change needs to happen at the top for things to really last. So
I think so. Yeah. And, you know, for just different, what am I trying to say? You know, there are different sensitivities that come mm-hmm. from having people in leadership positions that are living the same experiences that BIPOC people are living and LGBTQIA people are living. You know, it's just different when that's actually your experience rather than you're trying to channel what you know that experience to be in a lot of different ways. So, you know, it's always interesting to me now what I feel like I'm seeing versus what I thought I would see when I was in school. And so I was wondering how that has been for you. Like, what were your expectations when you were an undergrad or a grad student of what your life would be like in the field? And how is it different than what you're living now?
Well, let's see. I mean, when I was an undergrad, I didn't even think I could do music. So that's one thing. But, you know.
prove that way wrong.
So that's one thing. But, you know, I just remember how, I don't know, I don't want this to sound bad, but it just seemed really elitist to me. And it seemed that the only people who were successful were people with privilege, like people who had resources, people who had money, people who could afford to, you know, like, you know, resources, like a nice fancy flute, you know, being able to live in New York City and parents pay for your apartment. Like, you know, like that was like my existence, like seeing people around me have this like help that, you know, was not, you know, like that was like, it just seemed like that was the only way to make it was to have like help, you know? You know, so not only like did I not see anybody like me, but it just felt like this was reserved for people who were rich. Like literally I thought that. And then, but now I'm seeing, you know, I mean, you can just even see in my own studio at Frost School of Music, you know, a third of my students are Black. And so like, I would never have had that experience, you know, in my own undergrad. And I've talked to them about it because, you know, I had them all, they played a new piece by Jesse Montgomery that the NFA commissioned. And the whole idea of that commission was done by Dr. David Brown from Michigan. He put together this idea because he wanted to commission a Black composer to write a piece performed by Black students. And, you know, because he wanted to uplift, you know, Black excellence. And he felt very, very strongly for this. And so we featured it on the 2021 virtual convention. And, you know, when I had my studio this year and I realized that this is like the most diverse studio I've ever had. And I was like, wow, this is like a really great opportunity to feature. So they performed it, and re-recorded it. And it's, you know, it just made my heart just like really sing just to, and I told him, I was like, you know, I never imagined that this could be possible, but now it is.
I remember last year, I think, that you did this whole series of recordings with your students mm-hmm. doing all of these different solo pieces. And it just like, it honestly like practically made me tear up because it was so incredible to see and to have them execute those pieces at such a high level. Like, I'm sure people who heard those pieces were like, oh, I've got to go pick that piece up. You know, it was just so great. It was just amazing. I
No,
think, yeah, I'm sorry, you were going to say.
it just was like, a great opportunity, for them to explore this repertoire. They all picked the music themselves, and so, and then, and this is all came at the time, and I think and one of the, I think she was maybe a student in the University of South Carolina, I'm not sure, someone created a database and passed it around all over social media, and I think now NFA has it and went with it and ran with it, and so all of this, like, sort of this really great energy of like wanting to find this music, I mean, it's been infectious. So, my students kind of felt it. They wanted to feature this music, and I see it happening all over, not just with my students, but all over. I'm seeing it. It's great, really great.
I mean, it's just great repertoire.
Yeah.
Like, who doesn't want to find great repertoire,
Yeah,
right?
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I know for me, I think I feel like diversity issues are bigger in the field than I was anticipating. And that was really disappointing to me because I sort of entered into the field with this idea that it was like all about art. Yay. And in fact, there are barriers and walls everywhere that people are constantly having to navigate. And at the I feel the hopefulness of things starting to change, but at the same time, I feel like we're coming from so much further behind than I realized. But again, I do think that there are pillars in the field that are helping to just advance these more equitable causes, which I think are starting to take hold and continuing to have momentum. And so it makes me hopeful that things are starting to change. And it's ultimately it's for the sake of the art and for the people both. And it's the way to get the richest the access to the richest art is to allow everyone to have a seat at the table,
Right. No, very well put. Absolutely. I agree. And, I'm excited at what I'm excited. I'm really excited at what NFA has done, and I remember being a part of the committee. We had these scholarships to help organizations and students have lessons that I still feel like people don't even know that this has been going on for over 30 years that the NFA been doing the scholarship program. And for some reason, I feel like it's just not as well known as it can be. And I know, and maybe it's just not as flashy of a program than, because it's like doing, but it's doing real work. It's like it's helping,
It is.
doing real work and finding people with such promise and, just, giving them a seat at the table, just like you said, and giving them those opportunities that they may not have had because of whatever, whatever resources that may not be there for them, and just, just giving that opportunity to people. And so I think that's really, really important. And so, I'm glad that the NFA, I'm really happy, and it's one of the best things about the NFA is that it is really committed to that.
It's true. Yeah. I served as a mentor for that for many years. And actually the student that I served, the person who took his place when he went on to college was his younger brother.
Oh,
And
wow.
yeah, it was so cool. But this was a family that really truly was so grateful and also so needed that assistance from the NFA. And the two boys were so, I mean, they were just fantastic students and not necessarily bound for music professionally, but music was an enormous part of their lives, an enormous part of their family life. And I really appreciated that the NFA was not making a distinction about who would be able to get the scholarship based on are they going to be an NFA member. It really was like who was a student that could really benefit from this scholarship. And I just really loved that approach. And it was actually a very positive experience for me too. Okay, so to close, what are your hopes for the next generation?
The hopes for the next generation.
We probably need another whole session for that.
I just hope it gets easier and easier. Like,
Yeah.
it's still not easy. It's still not easy. It's still, you know, and now we're facing, you know, with all of the struggles we've had, you know, in the past couple of years, you know, things are not easy at all. Things are in a way harder in since the pandemic. And so, you know, I just hope that, you know, things continue to rebound and that, you know, people look to new ways to find music, look to new avenues for art. And, you know, and I, you know, once we kind of get back to, as a society again, I think, you know, I think there's a lot of promise out there, but I mean, I really hope that, I just hope that the barriers continue to come down. And I hope that, you know, there is more equity in the arts in general. I think it just takes a lot of, you know, people standing up and people, you know, trying to make a difference in any way that they can. It doesn't have to be, you know, even though I said, you know, change really happens at the leadership level. But for that to happen, also, we need people on the ground doing the work as well. So, you right. know, people doing the work on the ground, I think, will also really, really be so, so important. And, you know, we need them. We need us to continue doing that, or else, you know, I'm not sure how positive things can get. But I think, you know, the more work we do, the better things will be.
I totally agree. I think for me, I really want, I feel like this rising generation is phenomenal. I mean, they've lived through this pandemic mm-hmm. and, you know, what they have endured and had to preserve in their sense of self is just very, very significant. But I feel like it's going to help them down the road to propel their lives forward even more powerfully. So, you know, for them to just feel really confident in what they're bringing to the field and to embrace who they are in every possible way and what their art has to say. And mm-hmm. I also really hope that the gatekeepers of the field just really understand what their responsibilities are mm-hmm. and how critical it is that they don't shut people out.
Right. Yeah, very well put. Absolutely. I agree 100%. 100%, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Jen, I could talk to you forever. I always love spending time with you. And I'm so grateful that you were willing to do this because I know how busy you are. And so, you know, any minute of Jennifer Grimm's time is worth gold times 10. So thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
Oh, you're so sweet. Thank you, Jenny. This has been so fun. Thank you so much for the kind invitation. And you know, I'm happy to talk to you anytime whatsoever. I'm going to do it again in Chicago and maybe hopefully before that for some other reason. So yeah,
for sure. Good. Definitely. Well, thank you again.
All right. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
All right. Bye.